Rapid Fire Podcast. Content discussed on this podcast is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals. Now, let's start with the quote of the week.
The Marines have a saying, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. The center of bringing any dream into fruition is self-discipline.
G'day everyone, welcome back to another Friday afternoon wrap. Gosh, it's another week, guys. Melbourne is starting to become lockdown free, Jazz. You must be happy, aren't you?
Oh, tell me about it, mate. It feels like we're in a jail. I don't know whether COVID is going to kill me or not, but the health issues will surely if I don't start going to gym soon.
I thought you don't need to go to gym. You've got a few kids running around in the house already, mate.
Actually, so, that's cool. They make me run a lot.
They make you exercise a lot, that's for sure. Whereas John probably, John, you've got three kids actually, so you'll be exercising even more.
Well, I look like Fat Bastard from the Austin Powers films. So, and on my wedding day, I six pack, all that stuff. It's just the minute I said, I do. it's a mess.
Is there something that you just take off, the six pack you could just take off after you said I do?
No, well, let me put this way. Closing the gyms had zero impact on me.
All right, but it's good to see some positivity on the Melbourne lockdown side of things, that's for sure. And hopefully we'll get more easing towards the next few weeks, because we definitely need Melbourne to join the rest of the Australia party in terms of this economic recovery, mate. Okay, what have we got? I've got a couple of pieces of news this week. Okay, so start off, first of all, I'll touch on a bit about the JobKeeper, the impact of JobKeeper and how it does with the business employment at the moment. We'll then touch on a bit of trend around the Seek job ads in comparison to pre-COVID. And then there's a graph about Australia property investors with a spread of one property, two properties and three or more properties in terms of the percentage. So it's a longer term trend. I think it would be interesting to have a bit of a discussion around that graph. Everyone's got different interpretations. So it's always fun. And then we've got, we'll jump straight into John's property update, got the auction clearance rates, how Sydney market's currently doing. And also we'll touch on a bit about the Melbourne listing, which apparently have rebounded sharply in the last 2 weeks, also ever since inspections have reopened up, which is great. Fantastic news for those, for agents and property sellers, owners, buyers, etc. in Melbourne. Yeah. So I'll jump in first about that first piece of news a bit, which has got the headline to say businesses shed more than 110,000 jobs after JobKeeper slashed. So this is talking about the JobKeeper transitioning from JobKeeper 1.0 to JobKeeper 2.0. I think we've always anticipated there will be a bit of a cliff, or inverted commas cliff, when the JobKeeper ceases, and a lot of businesses actually were not able to qualify for JobKeeper 2.0. So the question remains about how long these employers are able to keep the employees in the role without the support of JobKeeper. So this piece of article specifically talks about a bit of figures on what the real current impact is, and I'll read out a couple of lines here. So new figures show 115,000 jobs have been lost since the federal government slashed the rate of JobKeeper. Figures released by the ABS on Tuesday, so this Tuesday, revealed the numbers of payroll jobs in Australia fell by 0.9% over the 2 weeks to October 3rd. Based on rough extrapolation of ABS labour force data, that means businesses shed 113,000 jobs after the federal government cut the fortnightly JobKeeper payment from $1,500 to $1,200 for full-time workers and $1,500 to $750 for part-time workers. Okay, so I think, Jazz, we've touched on, I think you're always being a big, you've always been harping on the real impact of the JobKeeper when it ceases or when it starts to lose impact. That's when we know really what the economy is looking like. And I think this is giving us a bit of glimpse, because given the fact that a lot of businesses don't qualify, and we're already seeing, we're losing about 115 jobs at the moment based on extrapolation. And that's a horrible figure, unfortunately. So what are your thoughts, gents?
Look, the only thing to add is basically, I don't think the real impact is still out there yet from on this. Yep, on this front, in my opinion. Think about it. Victorian businesses that have been closed for the last few months now, when they start to open up, how many of them will truly want to actually open up and will be able to sustain themselves? And plus the JobKeeper seeker package that we always talk about, which finishes in March, April next year. So I think there's a little bit more to the story, but we'll have to wait and watch. Having said that, it's not doom and gloom at the same time. I mean, economy will pick up on some other fronts like mining and all that stuff. Maybe one state will suffer more than the other, like Victoria, probably in this case, maybe. It was a caveat that we always had to everything. And it's still a caveat up until March next year, in my opinion. But keen to hear what John thinks.
So at this point in time, losing 150,000 jobs is really bad, really bad. So there's a lot of pain out there. But I actually feel like that's baked into the cake already. The market's expecting this to be a horror show. So what's more important is actually where are these unemployment figures coming in versus expectations? And at this stage, they're actually beating expectations. Even if I'm distrustful of the methodology of how we measure these things, but still, the numbers are typically coming in better. So that's the first thing I'd say on, it's like, where are we coming in on expectations? Because this is already just a super bad economy. Second thing is, we're losing $150,000 jobs. But which jobs are they?
It's
115. So which jobs are they? Now, they're all, it's bad to lose any of these jobs, but as investors, and if we're thinking about being property investors, these jobs that are being lost are typically renters, not buyers. And the reason we're not seeing property prices come down is because the people who are losing their jobs are the renters and not the buyers. It's really bad, but it's just worth knowing. I was listening to a podcast the other day with the property guy, an American property guy, within the rich dad, poor dad ecosystem, the Robert Kiyosaki guy, and he is still very bearish on real estate. So he talks about because of these unemployment numbers, and he says that the tsunami happens after the earthquake. So you have the earthquake, that's the shutdown, and then it takes months and then you have the tsunami after. I actually personally don't buy into that. I think that low interest rates are going to overwhelm the downside, but you've got this, and this is where we keep coming back to it, you know. We've got a K-shaped recovery. We've got all this pain for people who are in the workforce or not in the workforce, and asset prices just aren't reflecting that.
Mm-hmm. Just on one point, JobKeeper and the job seeker is the reason. That was the reason that the real estate prices didn't tank. If that wasn't there, I think probably Steve Keen would have been right this time, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think you're right. He's been talking about 30-35% property market crashes in the absence of a global pandemic, though. So his thesis doesn't even factor in COVID-19, but I take your point. I think he would have been right. I think the right way to look at JobKeeper and JobSeeker is not as stimulus, but as compensation. We say that JobKeeper and JobSeeker is stimulating the economy. It's just compensation for the government not allowing you to go to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's worth pointing out that nationally, the payroll jobs remain around 4.1% lower than mid-March. So comparing to pre-COVID, it's about 4.1% at the moment, 7.7% lower in Victoria, and 2.8% lower in the rest of Australia. So, a lot of that figure, I would say, is because of the lockdown in Melbourne, unfortunately. So I guess in a few weeks' time when the lockdown's eased, and hopefully that'll also start to improve a bit, okay?
I'll add a footnote. We talk the concept, everyone's talking about JobKeeper cliffs and JobSeeker cliffs, and there are all these cliffs never materialise because there's always another program. You know, 2 years ago we were talking about the interest-only cliff in real estate mortgages. We were saying, you know, they're going to have to move on to P&I, that'll reset, and there will be this massive market crash. That didn't happen, and that didn't happen because there's always there's always a new program, there's always a refinance, and I think that JobKeeper, JobSeek is the same. I don't think there's a cliff. There will be another program and we'll roll into that and it might have another name. But
fair enough. Okay, well, let's move on to the next point then, which is also related to employment. So we've got the Seek job ads, and I think it's an interesting way how we interpret this graph. My reading of it is it compares the 100 mark or 100 index mark is actually the at one, if you put it as one. So anything above that is 1 point something, which is good. Anything below that is contraction. So, you know, less than one. And if we look at how currently September compares or towards October, how that compares with March 15th, which is, again, pre-COVID, we got Perth clearly being the winner here, about 1.2. So in comparison to back at that time, you know, it's actually the number of job ads is about 1.2 times what it had. Brisbane is marching towards one at the moment, which is also on a very positive news. Sydney is towards 0.7 and Melbourne is around 0.6-ish at the moment. So they're both on the upward trend right now is the way how I read it. Jazz, mm-hmm.
The only thing to add there is, I mean, and we've discussed that as well in the past, this clearly tells what Perth property market is going to do in the next few years, in my opinion. Again, Perth is known to be a boom and bust cycle. But looking at all these job numbers and the other activity in the mining space and the commodities that's happening, it tells us that Perth is going to be the winner this time in the property sector, in my opinion.
Finally, our Western Australia friends can actually start to get a bit of boom on their property cycles now, hopefully.
Or cover up their losses.
Given the fact that, yeah, they've had negative numbers for a number of years, definitely not that great. But, yeah, Perth is leading the employment chart at the moment. John, anything?
No, I would just echo what Jazz said, that these numbers, even though they're Seek job ads, it does suggest that we're at the beginning of a commodities boom in Western Australia that's going to make our ears burn.
Everything that you look at, whether it's the job numbers or if you speak to the locals on the ground, or if you look at the iron ore and the nickel, all the stuff that's happening in the solar space that requires rare earths, it's just screaming, basically.
Do we reckon it's going to be even bigger than it's around the 2012, 23, 2013 mining boom?
I do, but I think it'll be, it depends on the commodity. So in the last resources bull market, it was iron ore and those sorts of things, and it was because China was building its infrastructure and we were just digging things out of the ground and selling it to China, and that worked. I think this one will be a little bit different. I think it'll actually start with precious metals, and Australia's like the third biggest gold producer in the world. Mm-hmm. So we're going to benefit from it, but it will just take a different characteristic because China's in a different cycle. They're not building infrastructure. They're becoming consumers. And so it'll benefit us, but it'll just be a different type of commodity that that booms. Industrial commodities later in the decade and precious metals in the first half of the decade would be my guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, gold has already led the charge here. It's back to its all-time high.
What are we sitting on now, back to 2000?
Almost. It's about 1910, 1920. It's floating between 1800 to 2000 range, more 1850 to 2000 range. But it's clearly telling that the other commodities, whether it's silver or whatever else, will join the party soon.
Very good. All right. Next up, we've got the chart on Australia property investors' share of total by number of properties owned. This is a chart released by ATO, Macquarie Macro Strategy. It captures between 1999, or I should say just the 2000, the millennials, all the way up to now towards 2020. The percentage of investors who's got one property on one line, the percentage of investors got two properties on another, and three or more properties on the third line. So we got the trend here is we got the one property actually continuously coming down across the decade, interesting enough. Now it's marching more towards 70%, whereas back in the 2000s, it was around a 75, 76%. The number of property investors got two properties has actually increased over the decades. It started off around the 16%, and now it's moving towards the 20% mark. And those who's got three or more properties started off around 7% back in 2000 and now moving towards 10%. So, you know, those people who's got one property is decreasing. Percentage of that is decreasing, whereas the number of people who's got two or more properties is increasing over the years. That's an interesting trend. That's how I read this graph. I don't know. I think everyone's got different interpretations. Jazz, what do you reckon?
It's an interesting chart that you've got, David. So number of property investors out there overall are declining according to this chart, basically all the way from 80% down more towards 70 now, or 70 from 75 to 70. But the people who are holding multiple properties, whether two or three, is there's a little tiny increase in that, which is 2 or 3%.
My view on that is actually the slight increase in people who own multiple properties actually reflects the increase in interstate investing in the last 20 years. So in the last, say, 5 years, Hobart was the hottest capital city in Australia. And that was people from Sydney and Melbourne in particular, investing in Hobart real estate. Now, the thing about Hobart real estate is for every one Melbourne property, you can buy three properties in Hobart. Mm. So I actually think that multiple properties is a little, can be misleading, but I think actually it just reflects that the love affair with real estate continues, but the big change has been interstate investing.
But isn't it fair to say, John, looking at that one red line, that the majority of the investors are, I mean, that's a, I won't say sharp decline is not the right word, but
it's a rapid decline.
Yeah, but from 76% down to 70%. The big deal is the red line, the people walking away from property altogether, I thought, but we are reading it very differently. It's a red line that's looking interesting to me, that's all.
The biggest thing for me is, like, we've got lots of people who own one property. Like, let's say, let's split the difference and say 75% of property owners just own one property, and let's say 18% own two. That's a massive difference from 75 to 2%. So there aren't that many multiple property owners. What I think is that this just, so Australia is a country with a love affair for real estate. We talk about real estate at every barbecue, and as the three of us know, everyone's an expert in property.
Mm-hmm.
Except the data doesn't really reflect it. Most people, 75% of people, own one property. So I just kind of, I guess what I'm taking away is that the rhetoric at the barbecue about everyone being a real estate expert doesn't actually match the holdings that people have. Most people are own one property, and that's cool. That is excellent. But the romance that we have with real estate is not reflected by the number of properties we own.
Yeah. And I think it's a good point that you mentioned, John. You know, yes, if we look at the people are probably more open and more educated now, given the fact that how information is flowing more readily. And looking at interstate properties. So, you know, I think from 2010 onwards, in fact, from 2000 onwards, you know, number of properties for two and three properties and more is increasing, as you said, because people are diversifying into other interstates. And that kind of stuff, rather than looking at previously, they can only look into their backyard or the suburb or the same suburbs, right? And, you know, where they could be just capped out with one Sydney or Melbourne property versus two Tasmania property or even three Tasmania properties. So,
But that number is two and three properties. Trend line is a very slow, gradual growth. Whereas relatively, if you compare it to the red line, which is one property, number of people owning one property is declining at a faster rate compared to the two. Investors are shying away from
property. It's a sum, I think. Total has to add up to about 100%. That's my understanding. So if you think about it, you know, let's say, for example, that by now one property is 72%, two properties about, 18, and then three properties about 10, that adds up to about 100. So if one property goes down, then the two properties and three properties are going to have to step up.
I think your point, Jazz, is the market, the wisdom of the market, is the market saying that real estate at these prices, real estate at, let's say, 3% yield, it's just not worth it. And they're walking away and they're saying real estate's not the asset that it was for our parents in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
It's just not that compelling.
That's exactly how I'm looking at it, especially with the finance and all being lending me pretty tight in the last few years. Now it's being relaxed a little bit. So I don't know. Anyways.
I don't know. I still think that
But it's interesting, it's relatively flat given the fact that, you know, we've obviously had a few different cycles of finance, right? You know, got APRA, we got Royal Commission. There hasn't been much of a dip or like a V-curve or anything like that we can see from these trends, you know, for all three lines. So that was something that's interesting, because I would have thought that they would have fluctuated a lot more than being like a, you know, like these dabbling lines.
It is pretty stable. I mean, most people have one property. That's really clear from this chart.
Mm.
And the concept of equity. I mean, there was when Jan Summers went on Ray Martin in like 1982, and she talked for the first time about harvesting equity to buy the next property. No Australians were doing that. No one had heard of that. So the buying multiple properties didn't really come about until the 90s.
Interesting. This chart should be looked again in 5 years' time.
All right. Anything else? No. I think that then we'd then start moving on to John's. You've got the auction clearance rates. You want to give everyone a bit of update on auction clearance rates?
Yeah, we flagged, you know, months ago that the things were going to get fiery in Sydney. There were a little bit of a dip in the number of auctions that went up last weekend from 720 to 640, so a little bit of a dip, but the clearance rate's up at 79%. So Sydney's, you know, biggest market, probably the second most important auction market after Melbourne, and we're at 78% clearance rate. I think we're in a fully fledged bull market now. We need a few weeks on the data, but that's what I'm seeing. That compares to 81% last year, so we're down to 79% from 81. So it's a little bit down, but the number of properties are higher than last year in Sydney. So if I run through some of the other cities, Melbourne again, I don't think we should dwell on it because I think we've been deciphering muddy data, but 63% clearance rate. That's improving. Down on last year, but we really need to wait for the reopen. Brisbane always bounces around. Brisbane's not a key auction market, and the number of properties for sale dropped from 67 to 46, and the auction clearance rate is stable at about 60%. So that's pretty good, and it's way up on last year. So based on these numbers, it's reflecting what we're seeing, that Brisbane is actually recovering quite well, and Brisbane would be well into a bull market. Mm. Adelaide at 70% is down from 87% in the prior week, and Canberra 84% clearance rate. Canberra's doing really well. Canberra never really suffered in the March downturn either, so they've been very resilient. The only other thing I'd say on the clearance rates is that it's a house boom, not a unit boom. If we look at Sydney again, only because I've got that data in front of me, but the clearance rates for houses was at 81%, but for units is 73%. So not all property is doing great. The average is doing great, but it's about houses, and it's about the city fringe as opposed to in the city.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so property market's doing well.
Only number to look at over here is, to be honest, the Sydney number, and that is really good, to be honest. All the other ones, Melbourne, as you said, no point counting, and none of the other ones are worth even looking at because they're not really auction states. Brisbane, Adelaide, and Canberra, I mean, those numbers are pretty low that we are looking at from an auction perspective. But Sydney, definitely, clearly. It doesn't have WA. Yeah.
No, it's a bit unfair, isn't it? But we know WA is doing great. Just anecdotally, I can say I've got a property for rent at the moment, 2-bedroom unit, and no interest at all. And it's in a reasonably good area, always been rented, and it's the rental market's quiet. It's not a good time of year for it either. Mm. But there is pain in the real estate market, but it's for landlords.
Yeah, definitely. It's a lot more rental listings available at the moment, so renters can take their pick, right? So one of the best times to be a renter, to be honest, but one of the worst times to be a landlord. Everyone's had to keep dropping their rents in order to try to attract. Otherwise, you're just going to have to keep it vacant and keep paying the mortgage.
See, that's why I always keep asking, is property still a good investment? Property rights?
Depends on when you look at it, mate. That's any kind of snapshot that someone can give you
I'm going to be skeptical for the next at least 2 to 3 years, I think, even though we see all these numbers.
Well, the answer to that is always the same compared to what? So if real estate's no good, but compared to what, right? Bond, cash, yeah.
Well, these days it's gold, buddy.
He's always going to compare to Bitcoin. Come on, if you're asking, Jazz is always Bitcoin.
Bitcoin is more like speculation. Put 1% of your money in it. Nothing more than that.
Walked right into that. I should have known we're going to talk about Bitcoin.
All right, we digress. That was great. Thanks, John. And by the way, I think it's also a good segue in terms of bringing up the an interesting chart released by CourtLogic where Melbourne dwellings have since 28th of September, when the private real estate inspections can recommence, has rebounded strongly. So I think on 28th of September, it was hovering around 2,000 as a number of new listings. And up to 13th of October, now it's going back up to close to 8,000. That's almost four times. Definitely all those pent-up demand that's across the 3 months during the lockdown has now started to get released and it's coming back strong. So I think in a week or two, Melbourne numbers, I don't know how many listings is available for auctions this weekend. In fact, it will be interesting to see next weekend's numbers and what sort of clearance rate that would have we'll be seeing and how that impacts the Melbourne property prices or Victoria property prices will be interesting.
Yeah, that's one to be watched, definitely. I'm really keen to see how market or the buyers and the sellers are going to take this one. All of a sudden, the listings shoot up, and then obviously there's a pent-up demand as well. Whether that will really get reflected in the prices or the prices will stay follow the normal course, that's something to be watched.
I think the Victorians are chomping on the bit to get back to their
Yeah, rent. They definitely are. I think, it's good. All right, well, I think next week when you cover the auction clearance rate, I think we'll be able to start covering and digging a bit more into the Victoria markets as well. The next graph, I think, John, that one's yours as well. Investors as a percentage of total housing finance commitments based on that exclusive financing. Anything you want to add on that one?
The charts have state-by-state number of investors participating in the real estate market, and it's just a straight line down over the last couple of decades. So we're at lows for investor participation. No surprises there. Investors still remain strongest in Sydney, but apart from that, it's a bit of a mix. Nothing to add other than we already know that the investors aren't particularly interested in real estate. I would also say that first home buyers have kind of picked up where investors have left off. So they've left a bit of a gap, but owner-occupiers, in particular first home buyers, have stepped in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just the interesting bit, again, is the WA, how it's got the positive slope on it, which is trending upwards for the investors, and ACT. Look at the ACT, how sharp the turn is there. So, yeah, and makes sense. I mean, those two totally make sense. ACT being a lot of government jobs cropping up, my guess is, with all the stuff that's been happening. And WA, we have talked a lot about that. No point mentioning much. Rest everything else is still trending downwards or neutral.
If you're a speculator, the charts suggest it's time to get into Darwin. I have no view on Darwin at all, but investors make up 12% there, where it's, by contrast, it's 27% in Sydney. So no investors up in Darwin at the moment.
Well, if you're a speculator, I'll say go into WA.
You're in the WA, yeah.
It's a safe speculation.
Yeah. Ride the upcoming commodity mining boom, eh?
Yeah, exactly. get in at the time, get out at the time. Just don't get too greedy when you see a 300% rise in your property market in 2 days.
Might have better luck in Bitcoin than anything else if you want to play that kind of speculative game. But you know what? It will be interesting.
Only get into Bitcoin if you can take a 90% drop.
Without being sent to hospital.
Exactly.
Carried in. You know what will be interesting? It will be interesting to overlap this graph with the new housing commitments for first home buyers and owner occupiers, for different states. I think that that'll give us some interesting figures, because that'll give us a real picture about we know who's been holding and whether there's a correlation between you know, an increasing number of first-time buyers and versus a decreasing number, and what the proportion is like to a degree. So anyway,
anything else, gents?
Yes, there's one thing.
Crypto?
I don't know whether you've seen this one, David, or not, but yeah. I don't remember whether I sent this link to John or whether John sent it to me, but it talked about the reset of the monetary system by none other than IMF. So not some random guy on the street. This is IMF talking about it, which is a Bretton Woods-style reset. John, talk, buddy.
Oh, Jazz, yes, you've got me on my favourite topic. I think you sent it to me, by the way, to answer that little mysterious question, but I've been obsessed with it ever since. So this was something that happened over the weekend where, as you said, the IMF came out and said we need a new Bretton Woods. And the Bretton Woods, the new monetary system that they're envisaging would be based on a digital currency, or what they call a CBDC. A CBDC is a central bank digital currency. This scares the bejesus out of me. A couple of reasons, right? So Bretton Woods was the last time we all got together. The war was ending. It was 1944, and Keynes kind of led, John Maynard Keynes, the economist, led the discussion about a new monetary order. And it's when the US said to the world, we'll take your gold, we will peg the dollar to gold. I think it was 40% of it was pegged to gold at the time. And if you guys peg your currencies to the US dollar, you've got an indirect peg to gold, and we're all good. And we'll protect the gold, because we don't leave the gold in Europe, because Europe has a war every 30 years, right? So that was the reasoning at the time. Now, that lasted until 1971, when America was losing all the gold and they went off the gold standard. We've been on an unbacked paper system ever since. So what the IMF said was that they want to move us on to a digital currency. Now, this is the biggest news of the week. So what can they do with a digital currency? Well, they can track everything we spend. We can pay taxes automatically, so they can just deduct money out of our account for taxes. They can give us universal basic income, that money just pops into our account. But it can also expire if we don't spend it in time, or if we don't spend it the way they want us to spend it. A digital currency gives, insert central authority, complete power over our financial and economic lives. Now, they'll sell it to us as though it's leading to all sorts of convenience, and it will. It will be convenient. It will be better in many ways. But everything will be tracked. Everything will be monitored. It scares me. You know the other thing they can do? If you express the wrong political view, they can cut off your digital currency as well. Mm-hmm. It's really scary stuff. There's a couple of other implications, but before we go there, what do you guys think? Digital currency?
All of a sudden, China is trialing their digital currency, which we discussed last week. So along with other countries talking about it a lot. So
We had I read E.B. Tucker's book, Why Gold, Why Now, and surprise, we've got a special guest coming up on the show, but E.B. Tucker in his book talks nervously about why governments and central banks are so excited about digital currencies. Why would they be excited about digital currencies? And it gives them all the control that we talked about. The real question is, what's the solution? If you're worried about privacy and all that sort of stuff, is Bitcoin part of the problem, or is Bitcoin part of the solution?
That's why it's a speculation. You never want to put more than 1% of your money into it.
Yeah.
Whether it's a part of the problem or is it part of the solution, nobody knows. But the thing is, it is not a part of the current monetary system. So if it's not a part of the current monetary system, and the monetary system needs to be reset, then I'll call it a flight to safety, maybe.
Mm.
But then others call it tulip mania. So different people, different opinions.
Yeah. The other thing with, so the two other things that, the reason why a global digital currency could be completely earth-shattering and changing is, one, if central banks can insert money directly into our bank accounts. Do we need banks?
I think I mentioned that maybe in 5 to 10 years' time, we won't even see all these middle banks. There will just be a central bank who'll have a full tap on everyone, where how much money they've got there in their bank account. They can shut down the accounts anytime, which is you're being fully tracked, and all these middlemen, which is all the other banks, will disappear. And you'll have a Fed coin, a Oz coin, whatever, Greece coin, whatever it is, basically.
Yeah. And well, here's the other thing where we start to get a bit international. What happens to the SWIFT system? So the way the US can control where money goes is they block people out of the SWIFT system. So if they've got sanctions on Iran, they say Iran can't use the SWIFT system because it's a US-dominated money transfer system. So you don't need SWIFT. So what happens? Do you need what happens to the US dollar if you've got global centrally planned digital currencies? So I think it's part of a de-dollarization. That's why I think China and Russia are for it, and the IMF is for it. That's kind of...
So US basically can't apply sanctions anymore on all the other countries, which is what it has been doing so far to maintain its power while misusing or abusing the system to some extent.
In some respects, absolutely. Yeah. Watch this space. I don't think we're going to like socialism very much. I think we've got used to part of it. That's the thing, though. The reference to Bretton Woods was interesting because Keynes himself was a Fabian socialist. So he had an idea for a currency, a one world currency called the bancor. And I think that when they talk about Bretton Woods and when they talk about Keynes, that's a nod and a wink to the bancor, which is his suggested global currency, and some other aspects of socialism, which we pretty much already have anyway. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're going to like it very much.
You know, the other thing, all of a sudden, these cash bans that they talk about, the cash needs to be banned. The whole reason of banning the cash is, once again, if you are transacting through tech, then one or the other way you can be tracked. So although it will not be that easier, but at least if there's no cash, then it becomes easier. Then if there's no middle banks and there's only one central bank with their own coin, then it's super easy now. They can see everything. It's like a
Big Brother coin, right?
Big Brother. That's it. I was looking for the word. That's it. Big Brother. Big Brother. We've got a Big Brother coin.
Big Brother coin.
I think you should patent that one, mate. that's the right
one. Just give me a sec. I'm just going to jump on now. Get it patented.
Have you heard the coronavirus being called COVID 1984?
Why 1984?
The book by George Orwell.
Oh, right. Yeah. That book.
COVID 1984. You know what I felt? There was a movie in the 90s with Mel Gibson where it was called Conspiracy Theory, right? And he was a taxi driver who'd go around and he would wax lyrical to his passengers about conspiracies. Now, the point of the movie was that one of his conspiracies was true, but he didn't know which one it was. And so, like, the government was after him. I feel a bit like that guy. Like, I think something's wrong, but I don't know what it is.
We don't have all the information, obviously, at hand. It's just whatever we read, we talk about. Maybe we're completely wrong. So don't listen to us. We're just having fun there. So listeners, again, none of this is financial advice. All the stuff that we have talked, we talk silly stuff. We don't have all the facts. It's just pure fun. Make what you want to make of it, but don't invest by listening to us. Play safe, stay safe, and we'll see you guys next week. Cheers.